My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Hi, and welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, Richard Astep, author and investigator, joins us to discuss his two most recent books, The Haunting of Fox Hollow Farm and The Black Monk of Pontefract. We venture into a territory I've not really dived into before, that of serial killers. So we touch on Herb Baumeister, Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and a couple of other notorious murderers. Before we join Richard, thank you again for the positive feedback for last week's episode with Brennan and Ian, who are always a joy to talk to and have been a torchbearer for the show and become firm friends. Thanks to both of them for their continued support. As usual, you can follow us across all social media channels and please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. So, make sure the doors are locked, the bolts and chains are on, and join me and Richard as we delve into the dark minds of serial killers and the ghosts they leave behind. My guest this week is, according to his own biography on his website, an author, paranormal investigator, and harshly in my humble opinion, D-list celebrity, Richard Astep. Richard originally hails from Leicestershire in the UK and moved to America in 1999, forming the Boulder County Paranormal Research Society in 2006. Since then, Richard has authored several books and has become well known through television appearances. Richard, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. Delighted to finally have you on the show, sir.
Afternoon, Paul, or good evening for you over in the UK. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Someone whose work I've followed for quite a while, Richard, primarily through hearing you when you were being interviewed on the wonderful Howard Hughes's The Unexplained. So that's how I kind of discovered you, if that makes sense.
And that was a great show.
Yeah, he's fabulous, Howard. He's a real sort of trendsetter for anybody in the paranormal field, especially here in the UK, because Howard's been doing it for well over 10 years. So I've always interested to see who Howard has on and everything. And obviously you've been on there two or three times, I believe, Richard, over the years.
Yeah, that's right. I keep getting to go back and it's always a good time.
Yeah. So ideally, I mean, obviously, as I'm sure you've discovered and most people know, you're originally from the UK. You moved out there in 99, and you're living in Colorado, I believe, these days.
Yeah, that's right. I'm from Leicester originally, but I have family in Hull and Bradford, so I spent a lot of time in those two cities up north.
Ah, very good, very good. You're always all right with a bit of extra Yorkshire visiting rights there, Richard, and I'm surprised to see we let you back out, so congratulations on escaping.
You know what? I love Yorkshire. Some of the best people in the world, truly.
Yeah, it's a nice place. I'm very lucky to live where I live.
Also, if I don't say that, my sister will beat the crap out of me.
Yes, that famous Yorkshire temperament. So, obviously, I've heard you interviewed several times, and it was quite interesting to hear that it was discovering the work of Peter Underwood. As a child, that kind of opened your mind to the paranormal. I think Peter's one of those people that sadly a lot of modern lovers of the paranormal don't seem to appreciate as much. So do you think Peter's work was the catalyst for opening your, obviously along, I believe you had some personal experiences as a child as well, Richard. Do you think Peter was the kind of the catalyst that pushed you on to embrace your love of the paranormal?
You know, 100%. And I think, I don't know why this is either, but Peter Underwood does not get the recognition or respect I think that he deserves. And nobody here in America really seems to have heard of him, which it's tragic. It really is. And I think it's because there was no razzmatazz with him. He was the old gentleman ghost hunter, you know, the tweed jacket and the kind of nice, polite. He looked like a teacher, you know. And I shudder to think what he would have made of the field today. But you knew that when you read one of Peter Underwood's books, you could sit down on a dark night in front of the fire, you know, the gas fire, and just sit and read and fall into those kind of books. And it kind of interests me that he did pretty much everywhere, right? He hit every haunted location you could imagine, for the most part. Never found any demons. Never found anything dark and horrific. There were one or two scary, I think, cases he wrote about, like Barry Pomeroy Castle. That one springs to mind. But he was truly, I think, the last of the gentleman ghost hunters.
Yeah, I think for me, as a child of the 70s, Richard, he was instrumental, along with the wonderful books written by John and Anne Spencer. Just fabulous compendiums of ghost stories from the UK and around the world. So I completely agree. I think Peter is probably one of the leading lights of the British paranormal world that simply seems to have dropped off the face of the earth. And I don't understand why he's lost his position as you know. Obviously he was the chairman of the Ghost Club, which always astounded me as a child that there was such an organization called the Ghost Club.
Yeah, I think, again, it was just the lack of the spectacular with Peter. He did so much legwork. You know, if there was a haunted location, he'd been there. Pretty much, but you didn't see him. He would write about it and then just kind of move on. And it's good to see that. I was chatting briefly with some of his family members on social media a while back, because they're releasing his books on Audible, which is really cool.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so some of Peter's books are already available, with hopefully more coming, on Audible. And if you're not aware of this man, Peter Underwood, pick up one of his books. They're all on Kindle. They're getting reissued. Some of the rarer ones are getting reissued on Kindle. Pick them up, and they're incredible. They absolutely are.
Yeah, absolutely. Always reminds me of it as being a young boy late at night with the little lamp on, reading these stories and thinking, right, I think I'd best put that down now and try and rest.
Yeah, but before there was a Most Haunted or a Ghost Adventures or whatever you want to call it, you know, there were those books. And I kind of think, I hate to be one of these, you know, back in my day, but I kind of think we were better off.
Yes. Yeah. I must admit, I share your opinion of the D word. and the fact that, like you say, Peter was very matter of a fact, but he was brilliant at investigation, establishing the facts and the history, and then just saying, here you are. He didn't, you know, there was no whistles and bells. It was just straight up simple facts. And I think maybe that is the reason, sadly, but I'm delighted to hear that. That's fantastic news about all the re-releases.
Yeah, I think it's good that those books aren't going to be lost. You know, the Kindle releases, which you can pick up for just a couple of quid, most of them, these are books that went out of print a while ago, which is a crime in my opinion. So to see them being re-released and the opportunity to pick them up. A new Peter Underwood book was always, for me, I would buy it without question, no matter what it was about. So, you know, a whole new generation should be able to come to his work, and I think it's fantastic.
Absolutely. I think he's one of the authors, along with Colin Wilson, whose books I bought as a teenager, I still own to this day. I've managed to update a couple for slightly better, better looked after versions than the ones that I had as a teenager, but he's an essential part of any paranormal collection for me, I think, Richard. I think we both agree on that.
Yep, couldn't agree with you more.
So, in regards to your work, obviously, you've built up a fantastic body of work, Richard. And what I've always appreciated about the things you do, be it on television or in your own writing, is a very similarly balanced approach when you're dealing with certain cases. And I know your last two books have been particularly interesting cases. One, I think, is once again seems to be one of those cases that, unless you really know about serial killers or American paranormal stories, Fox Hollow Farm seems to not be as well known especially over here in the UK, I think, as perhaps it deserves to be, because that is either part of that story, either the original grisly murders and the person who we assume is responsible. I think the evidence clearly points to someone. And then obviously the secondary aspect to it, that it then created this kind of paranormal activity in the area. Fox Hollow Farm is an extremely perplexing and mysterious situation, I think.
Fox Hollow Farm, you're right. So Herb Baumeister, the I-70 Strangler, is not well known here in the States either. He's you see all of these shows, you know, 10 scariest serial killers and stuff like that. And he does not make those lists. and so when people look him up, they're often surprised at his existence. And I think because he was a very unremarkable looking guy, he didn't have that look of a Gacy or a Manson or anybody like that. You know, he looked like your bank manager. No offense to bank managers, obviously.
Yeah, just throw that in there. Yeah.
Right. But he's also relatively recent, but he, his story is just an awful one. And the short version for your listeners is that he was a married man, multimillionaire, made his living with a chain of, well, we call them pound stores in the UK, discount stores. He had a private life that was very, very secret. When his wife was away, he would go to gay bars in Indianapolis. He would pick up men and then bring them back to his house, and he would murder them in the swimming pool he had downstairs in the basement. And then he would drag the bodies out into the woods behind the farm. He would allow them to just rot and decompose out there. Didn't even bury them. So, you know, it's a pretty awful thing. And he's responsible for anywhere between 11 and 20 murders. The number varies, and we'll never know how many for sure.
Yeah.
But what's unique about Fox Hollow Farm, most locations where events like that take place are quite understandably demolished, you know? They don't want them to become a shrine or to attract the ghoulish. But Fox Hollow Farm is in private hands. It's still owned and lived in by a family, so it still stands almost exactly as it did at the time of the murders. Yeah. And they let me move in.
Which is very kind of them. I suppose living there, that, you know, someone else being knocking around with all those ghosts, I suppose, who cares if you're moving in, Richard?
Yeah, exactly. We were better behaved.
Yeah, I mean, Baumeister is if you read his case, he seems to be having all the warning signs of someone who is clearly living a parallel life, because his early life, there's a lot of anger and a lot of very strange behaviour, seemed to be very socially awkward, didn't really fit in. And I think some people were quite surprised he ended up getting married, because he seemed unable to kind of fit into what the parameters of being a normal member of society is, because he had quite a macabre sense of humour, I think is the nicest way I can put it.
He his nickname was Weird Herb, which was a clue. So, you know, yeah, there were clues there. And I think it's pretty obvious to the people that knew him that he was a strange man. But, I mean, you know, you could say the same about me. I like weird. Weird is my people.
Yes.
Because it's not exactly normal to poke around derelict old buildings in the dead of night looking for dead people, you know? So I refuse to judge people when someone tells me they have a strange or a weird kind of reputation. But
yeah,
there's weird, and then there's, like, weird with a capital W, you know?
Yes.
And he's that guy that gave people the creeps.
Yeah, it's a very... I saw a program a few years ago about Baumeister, and like you referred to earlier, Richard, I was very surprised he's not as well known as he should be, because do you think that's, you know, without wishing to cast aspersions on anybody at the period, do you think it was because he was trailing gay bars and picking up young, single, unattached gay men that people just, he was allowed to do what he did for as long as he did? Because there's some kind of parallel for me in regards to Dennis Nielsen here in the UK, where this man was rampantly assaulting people. Some people survived, went to the police, and were just not believed because they were gay. Do you think that had any kind of part to play in the fact that why he was allowed to go under the radar, as it was, until it all came tumbling out?
Well, remembering the period this took place, you know, the early to mid-90s, You had the AIDS epidemic was rampant in headline news, and people actually said, not just the police, but people in general, when gay men were disappearing, they said, "Oh, they probably died of AIDS," which is awful. Or they probably just moved on to another town because this was not an okay time to be gay. And so I think that although the police, when they were told about all these disappearances, they did put undercover officers in the various gay bars, and so forth. But Herb Baumeister was very, very cunning right up until the point where he wasn't, where he would choose and target men that would have no families, that would only be missed by other members of the gay community. So people, who wouldn't raise hell if their loved one went missing. And that one of the reasons he finally was caught was he picked on someone whose mother kicked up enough of a stink and hired a private detective.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the worrying aspects about that case was the investigator. I think he did he get knocked back two or three times because he was basically saying, "I think there's a serial killer on the loose here," and they were just like, "No, we're not bothered."
It was a case of if you murder certain people, I think you're more likely to get away with it. You're going to get less scrutiny. And this was a population where, gay men disappeared all the time. And you would just hear comments like, "I probably went to San Francisco," or, something of that nature. But there came a point when it couldn't be ignored. And the police, like I said, they did put out undercover operatives at the gay bars. They did have a missing men campaign. But Herb Baumeister was, what's the best way to put it? He would go cold every once in a while. He wouldn't kill anybody for 6 months. And so they can only keep, those kind of campaigns up for so long.
Yeah, very much so. And I suppose he, which is very unusual because usually he seemed quite calculating in the way he would work like that, because I think often when people talk about serial killers, Bundy is a prime example where he just seemed to become more and more frenzied the longer he went on, and basically lost control towards the end. Not that, I'm saying his earlier behaviour was, well, it certainly showed some degree of control in the aspects of how he was able to function as a what would seem a normal human being to the outside world. And it's very interesting that he was able to sort of work to this kind of time frame throughout that period, throwing them off the scent.
Yeah, Bundy was an interesting case, wasn't he? He was kind of, well, massively egotistical, very charismatic, which Herb wasn't. So he was the opposite of Herb in that regard. Herb was a very shy kind of man. In fact, I talked to one person who knew him fairly well, and he said that if you yelled at Herb Baumeister, if you were confrontational with him, he would look down, he would leave the room rather than get into your face. He was not overtly violent, but he also couldn't charm you. Bundy charmed people. He had those kind of handsome looks. If you look at the actors that have played Bundy on TV and in the movies, Zac Efron and people like that, Mark Harmon. So Bundy had that going for him. But underneath, he was so used to getting his own way. And there came a time when just Bundy just couldn't stop himself, which he broke into a sorority house one night, I know, and killed two women and brutally attacked two more. And then when every cop in the area descended on the sorority house, he went a few streets away and did it again while they were investigating what he'd just done. Unbelievable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Baumeister is there is something as you say about in regards to him picking his certain victims that also sort of reminded me of the gentleman that's been making the headlines over the last year, especially in the States. I believe his name's Charles Little, who they who has claimed to have killed over 90 women. The majority of who are what were used to be labelled transients, which is never a nice term, but essentially most of them were prostitutes or working ladies. And his, if I mean, even if half of it's true, which I think they've got to a point where I think they've identified quite a number of these victims through what Little said, it's a terrifying amount.
Well, and it seems to be that with the current fascination we have for serial murders and these kind of things, there are more people that are almost taking pride in claiming to have done this kind of stuff. I think was it Samuel Little?
Oh, Samuel Little, that's the gentleman. Yes, not Charles. Apologies to anybody called Charles Little.
Yeah, there's a barman somewhere that's really not happy with you right now called Charlie Little.
Oh well. Join the queue. But
But yeah, he claims to have been killing people over the space of like 3.5 decades.
Yeah.
And it's tough to tell, isn't it?
It is. I mean, obviously he's been in incarceration. I think he's still working, and they're still working through the cases. But I keep seeing stories pop up every sort of 6 weeks or so from the States about they've identified somebody else, and he's pointed out something else. So there seems to be a lot of it. But as I'm sure you well know, Richard, serial killers are prone to exaggeration. Some of them love to kind of say, "Oh yeah, I've killed maybe even double the cases." I know Bundy often used to brag towards. Mind you, I don't think anybody knew what Bundy was telling was real or truthful, to be honest, with the amount of women that he was successfully linked with their murders. But there often seems to be that kind of move towards exaggeration, as though they want to be the most notorious.
Yeah, and I think once they're caught, all bets are off, right? Once they're behind bars, they no longer have anything to lose. And so you kind of then see it becomes bragging rights for them. They want to go down in history. But you also see, though, individuals like Ian Brady. And he was involved in this vile scheme where he strung out, the location, given up the location of those poor kids' bodies in exchange for oh, what's the term I'm looking for? Whether it was because he wanted to inflict more pain, you see it almost become more of a sick and twisted game for those individuals. And I've seen several serial killers here in the States that are on death row, and they've tried to stave off their execution, gain a stay of execution, by saying, "Oh, I think I can remember where I buried this one victim. I'll take you there," until finally the cops just say, "No, thanks. I've had enough."
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where, for the grace of God go I, because that's not a situation I would like to be, if I worked for the police, Richard, regardless of where you are in the world. It's nobody wants to be dealing with that kind of scenario at all, I think. I think the trauma that could simply affect someone dealing with the case is imaginable.
It is, and they tend to be very long, protracted affairs, very strung out, and you feel for the families of the victims that, his name escapes me, and for that I apologize, but I believe it was Keith Bennett, correct me if I'm wrong, with the Moores murders that was never found, and his mum, I mean, his mum used to go onto the Moors and dig, trying to find her son. So to put somebody through not just the murder, but that is just awful.
I remember because obviously Saddleworth Moor, where they took their victims, is obviously on the way from Yorkshire to Manchester. So you have to go past Saddleworth Moor, and it's one of those stories that as a young man, we were always aware of, primarily because it was he was often himself and Myra Hindley were always the archetypals don't talk to strangers. Because that's what they used to do. They used to cruise around and pick up teenagers, essentially, and then subject them to horrific crimes. But so I remember many a time, like you say, Keith Bennett's family searching themselves, and occasionally Brady would pretend, because he would often lead them on wild goose chases across the moors, as though he took some great amusement out of leading everybody along this horrifically sickening dance.
Yeah, awful, awful, awful excuse for a human being.
I think that's putting it mildly. So listen, we diverged a little bit there, but
I think we did.
thank you for. But hey, that's the world of serial killers. But the thing about the back to Baumeister, when did Fox Hollow Farm go on the market then? Because I believe Baumeister was found dead in his car. Was it 1996?
Yeah, he shot himself in the head in Canada. He crossed the border into Canada when he knew they were gonna turn over his house and rumble him. So he drove across the border to Canada, shot himself on a beach, and so all ended. His wife and kids, quite understandably, in my opinion, his wife wanted, to change the name and get away from the things her husband had done. So Fox Hollow actually was left standing abandoned for a few years. Only raccoons lived there. And it fell into a little bit of disrepair. And then when it was purchased early 2000s by my friend and co-writer Rob Graves, and that's not a pseudonym, I get asked that all the time. His name genuinely is Robert Graves, or Rob Graves as he prefers. They got it at a significant discount because it had one of those reputations, as in you can get this gorgeous house and estate, and you can get it at a relative knockdown price. You just have to be okay with what took place there. And Rob's a very skeptical man. When he and I wrote the Fox Hollow book, he's arguably the foremost expert on the Herb Baumeister murders, you know, and he has a unique perspective, Paul. He sleeps in Herb Baumeister's bedroom, you know. He writes his stuff in Herb Baumeister's study. A lot of Herb's books are still there. So, you know, Herb Baumeister, it's kind of interesting. So he knows pretty much everything about the man that there is to know. And Rob said, "You do the ghosts because that's your thing, and I'll do the murderer stuff." And that's kind of how we worked on the book, you know. And it's fascinating because Rob's very skeptical. I mean, even with all the weird things that have happened at Fox Hollow, Rob's very skeptical. I mean, he's a coroner for starters. He does autopsies as part of his living. So, you know, and his wife, who is very skeptical also, but has had a number of experiences there at Fox Hollow. They're both scientific people who weren't prone to believing in this kind of stuff until they moved in with it.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to say often people seem to gravitate towards professions with a surname, and the fact that he's called Graves and he works in the field that he does, Richard, just it just one of those strange coincidences that comes along. But the thing about Fox Hollow, essentially, as soon as they moved in, it started the alleged paranormal activity. Well, I say alleged, it's extremely well recorded.
Well, that was a catalyst. And you're never wrong to say alleged, I know, because some people just flat don't believe this stuff. But there was a catalyst, and that is that a guy called Joe LeBlanc moved in with them, and he worked with Rob. So he was looking for a place of his own, and Fox Hollow is huge. It has what you'd call in Britain a granny annex, you know, one of those in-law quarters where if your parents need to move in with you, your grandma needs to move in, it's kind of built onto the house. So Rob and Vicky, his wife, decided they'd rent that out in order to defray some of the costs. And it's when Joe moved in, and Joe was a single young man about the same age as some of the victims, that's when things really kicked into high gear at Fox Hollow.
I mean, it's also one of those very interesting locations where there seems to be a variety of phenomena as well, Richard. It isn't just disembodied voices or creaking here and there or strange things. It seems to be a lot of different facets of the paranormal all sort of occurring in the same area, which I always find extremely interesting because it seems to flag it as a high level of activity across a range.
Yeah, and having done some research and talked to other investigators, I've learned from them that they think there is more going on at Fox Hollow than just the activity associated with Herb Baumeister. The woods around there, for example, there are several that I talk to that say there is an elemental nature spirit that is active in those woods. I mean, you have a lot of history in that part of Indiana, you know, so a lot of Native American history going back many centuries. So I think it may be layered and more complex than that.
Yeah, there's several ingredients in that pot that's just created this perfect storm of terrifying experiences.
Absolutely. And I talked to one of the a gentleman who was almost a victim of Herb Baumeister's but managed to get away. And he told me that when he was at Fox Hollow, he saw apparitions there, that it had a reputation for being haunted at before Herb Baumeister died.
Yes. Oh,
So,
very interesting. Is that the chap that pretended to pass out, so he left him alone?
yeah, absolutely.
Yes, I've read his testimony. It's absolutely, once again, paralleling Dennis Nielsen, because I think one of Nielsen's, well, I know one of Nielsen's victims escaped, but the weird thing about that was he continued to have a friendship with him after that. It was a very, very weird kind of scenario that. And if you've never come across Dennis Nielsen, for anybody, because a lot of our listeners are in the States, Richard, Dennis Nielsen is one of Britain's most notorious murderers.
Yeah,
Shocking.
I'm familiar with Dennis Nielsen, and you're right, there are parallels with Herb Baumeister. He was that same kind of wouldn't look out of place behind a bank desk kind of guy. I feel like I'm picking on bankers for no reason here as well. You know, wouldn't look out of place in an insurance office or you know, any office at all.
Yeah, well, Nielsen did work. He worked for the Department of Work and Pensions. He worked with unemployment benefits. So he was I think he was a junior manager as well. So yeah, he was one of those conspicuous by his normality in that kind of scenario.
I find that pretty easy to believe. And again, they hide in plain sight, don't they?
Yes, very true. I mean, when you went there, how long did you spend living there, Richard?
So overall, we were there for 6 days and nights, but I split it in half. So I did half of it in the spring when it was warmer, sunnier weather, and half of it in November when it was freezing cold, and which made it very stupid time of the year to get into the swimming pool there, where the murders took place. But so I wanted to do it at two different times of the year to see if that would have an effect.
Did you notice any kind of upturn? Did you, as you refer to there, it would be more prolific in certain seasons, or do you think it is such a consistent level of situation that it just continues throughout the year at all?
I don't think the seasons had a huge impact on it, honestly. I think that having Joe LeBlanc come back was probably the biggest catalyst that we had, the biggest trigger in order to get paranormal activity. And I also think that putting people into the pool had a similar effect.
That's an invitation I'd probably always decline, Richard, I have to say.
You know, I'd seen it on I'd seen the show on, excuse me, I'd seen the location on the show Ghost Adventures, and they had never gotten in the pool, and I was almost like screaming at the TV, you know, if you really are into this, if you're really trying to, I don't want to say provoke, but if you're really trying to stimulate something, why would you not get in there? So when I got there, I did.
I mean, having read the reports and your book on the case, Richard, it does seem that, like I referred to at the beginning when I was introducing yourself and your work, I think even you were surprised at just how active it was. Were you prepared for what happened, or did you just kind of think, well, yeah, another allegedly terrifyingly haunted house?
Well, I think, I mean, we were prepared, but it's important to remember when I write those kind of books, my job is to cut out the boring bits. So
Yes.
what you don't get is hours and hours and hours of me and my team sitting around on our asses waiting for stuff to happen. You know, because who wants to read that? You know? So I think that although when you read the book, it reads like things are flying off the walls all the time. In reality, we had, you know, hours and sometimes days when nothing remarkable happened at all. And then it would surprise you. It's like waiting for a bus, you know, nothing for an hour and then two come along at once.
Very well. I think that's the problem these days with the modern version of a ghost hunt, Richard, that people tend to think it's a consistent thing. And I've said, having done a few myself over the years, it's a damn boring business at best of times, is ghost hunting.
It is, and if you're in it for, I mean, I was a firefighter for 15 years, and I like to make that parallel. We spend, I would say, 90% of our time waiting around for the other 10%, and the other 10% can be terrifying when it comes. And so the same is true with ghost hunts and paranormal investigations. And I think we have the rise of paratourism these days, don't we? And I'm not knocking it, but I think there's an expectation that if you're going to go somewhere for 4 hours. You know, having written about 30 East Drive in Pontefract, that's a good example. The people that talk about that location, they'll say, you know, nothing happened. This place is not haunted. I was there for 6 hours and not a. And it's, you know, it's crazy. We put in, I mean, I lived at 30 East Drive in order to get some results. And there were a couple of days there when sod all happened, pardon my language.
Yes, oh, that's all right.
So, you know, when I write books, the one of the benefits for the reader is that I cut out a lot of the waiting around, and I think we may do a disservice. The TV shows are the same way. We cut out the waiting, and therefore there's this, we create this false impression that it's all go, 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 and it isn't the case.
Well, it's interesting you touch, like, as we referred to as a Yorkshireman, the case in Pontefract has been well known in my locality for quite a long time, and I noticed in the introduction to your book on the subject, ironically, I discovered the case the same way you did, which was reading Colin Wilson's book Poltergeist, which is a fabulous collection of stories.
It is, and wherever Colin may be, hats off to him.
Absolutely. Once again, as we refer to Peter, I think Colin's one of those authors and investigators that deserves a rebirth, as it were, in the modern world of paranormal, I think. And that book is incredibly detailed in some of that. So that's when the first time when I was thinking as a young man growing up in South Yorkshire, you know, it's 20 miles away. So I've never been in the house. I've been past it. You know, because it's, you know, not the kind of thing. Hello, can I come in your haunted house, please?
Actually, you know what? That happened all the bloody time when we were there. The gas man, the local police, the police will stop by when they have a new rookie officer,
Yes.
and so on. And I did something horrific there that I should still be ashamed of to this day. So I'm standing in the upstairs bedroom, which was Diane's bedroom, the teenage daughter,
Yes.
and so I'm setting up a camera, and then it's the summer, it's the height of summer, so no air conditioning, right? It's one of those muggy summers. So I have the window wide open, and I hear somebody outside, and I look out, and there's two young lads on bikes, you know. And one of them looks at me and goes, "Mister, is this the haunted house?" And I should never have done this. I'm amazed the police weren't called, actually. So I turn around and I look at them. I said, "Yes, it is, lads. Do you want to know a secret?" And they're like, "What?" And I said, "I died in here 40 years ago and I've never left." Right, and get this. So then I start squatting, like as if I'm sinking through the floor. So like I'm going down at the knees, you know, which is no picnic when you're 42 years old. But it looks like I'm sinking through below the window, and the screams, like you would have thought, and off they went. So, you know, to this day, there are two lads in Pontefract somewhere that think I haunt the East Drive. Sorry, lads, if you ever listen.
Well, fair play to you, Richard. I think that's brilliant. That would make me tickle. If you can make two lads from Pontefract scream, you're doing something right, I think.
Yeah, or Ponty, as everybody likes to call it.
yes, we do. We call it Ponty, the tip of the rhubarb triangle, as it's known in Yorkshire, where all the rhubarb in the UK grows near Pontefract. I don't know why,
Did not
but
know that.
yeah, no, it's between Pontefract, Harrogate, and somewhere else. It's known as the rhubarb triangle. It's one of those weird, boring facts I know about Pontefract and West Yorkshire in general. But I think, as you've referred to in the past, once again, Pontefract seems to be a case where I think people view it, once again, as you refer to in the book, quite similarly to the Enfield case, despite the fact that Pontefract has continued to have situations and experiences for people that go to this house that have continued right up to the modern era.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, Paul. So Enfield is on my bucket list. I know
Yes.
a lot of people have gone to the house and stood outside and taken pictures, you know, and tracked it down. I would honestly do that myself one day just to say
Yes.
I've been. But Enfield was more the classic prototypical poltergeist case. Poltergeist generally are the shooting stars of the paranormal world. They burn very brightly, very intensely, and then they burn out,
Yep.
which is kind of what happened, as documented by Playfair and Gross at Enfield. But
Absolutely.
yeah, but you have something else going on at 30 East Drive. And having talked, you know, to the locals, I mean, talk to Carol next door, the neighbor, that house has been active for decades, and it waxes and wanes. You know, there was a huge resurgence of interest when the movie, when the lights went out,
Yes.
came out. That's when things really kind of exploded again. And then, of course, you had Most Haunted and their popularization of the house. And now you have this constant stream of visitors that are in and out of that place. All of them a potential energy source.
Yeah, very much so. And you know, it's a regular occurrence. There's a company that will allow you to go there and do your own investigations. So it's certainly a place I think that's becoming more well known around the UK as one of Britain's most haunted hotspots, I would suggest.
Yeah, and the opposite too. I've had lots of people very confidently say since I wrote that book, "Oh, the whole thing's a fraud. It's just been put on by the owner to make money," which kind of annoys me because number one, I know the owner; he's a friend of mine. He gave me the keys to that house. He didn't ask me for a penny, and he said, "Write what you find." And if I'd found nothing, I would have written nothing, you know. So the experts that are talking about it, quote unquote experts, because there are none in this field. Have either been there for a limited amount of time, they've certainly not lived there, which is what we did, or have never been there at all. And you have to invest a lot of time and patience in a location like that in order to get rewards.
I mean, the other aspect, as we've touched on Enfield being continually people dismissing as a hoax, which, you know, as you always referred to in your introduction to the book, completely discounts numerous witnesses, including members of the police force. And Pontefract, I think, is a case that's very unusual due to the ferocity of the particular haunting, because, you know, the key focus during the original haunting that made it famous, I suppose, in paranormal circles, was obviously, I think, that was the girl was consistently... Was she dragged up the stairs backwards once, Richard?
Diane, the daughter of the house. That is what Colin documented, and that's what was what has been said. It sounds, I know, like fantastical. But there were numerous witnesses that that attested to it.
Yeah, and it's got those classic hauntings of extremely loud smashing noises and nothing happening, or other mm-hmm. times objects just being thrown violently across. But like you've said in the book, it's not what I don't think we could consider it a poltergeist, primarily because it's gone on for so long. It's clearly some different level of phenomena that's going on there, in my opinion anyway, Richard.
Yeah, I think it began as a poltergeist case, and you do still see poltergeist activity. I mean, the house was dormant for a while, and a big shout out to Andy Evans. And if you haven't read Andy's book, by the way, Don't Look Back in Anger, about the Black Mark, it's a terrific read. I encourage anyone who's interested in the house to read Andy's book. He went in there after the house had been dormant for many years and would find that a Bible had slid across the kitchen counter and stuff like that, which is classic poltergeist phenomena. And to this day, we get apports, you know, we get objects appearing and disappearing. So there are these poltergeist-like characteristics to it, but it's more complex than that. And so something you often hear talked about with regard to 30 East Drive is, you know, well, there's no actual history of a black monk. It's all made up. And they're absolutely right in that there's no evidence to suggest this story of a monk who molested young ladies and then was supposedly thrown down a well. There's no suggestion that that might be have its basis. In fact, I want to say that came from one researcher's account who spoke to Colin Wilson. You know, and then hence the black monk story, the mythos, was born. But there are a couple of interesting components to that, Paul. One is that I'm a big believer in the thought form theory. The fact that if a story is told often enough, it takes on a life of its own. I've seen it happen in various cases. So I think as the black monk has been talked about, the black monk has almost been created, you know? And what the Pritchard family saw may just have been a large black robed shadow figure who, you know, thanks to the tale growing and the telling, became the infamous black monk of Pontefract.
Absolutely. Very much akin to a tulpa, Richard.
Absolutely akin to a tulpa, the Tibetan term for it. And I've seen a couple of cases where that's happened. So I think that that's probably what's going on. He's not a monk at all, and I get that. You know, he's got the nickname now Fred, but which we also saw in Enfield, right? They gave the poltergeist a nickname in Enfield just to remove some of the fear. And as I recall, they even bought him a Christmas present one year and put it under the tree.
Try and help Bill out, bless him.
So the story that goes behind this, I think, is every bit as important, even if it isn't historically verifiable.
It is interesting as well, like you say, that often Fred is a very unusual, especially in this day and age, name, because it's not very common as it was perhaps 50, 60 years ago. It often makes me laugh, Richard, the amount of ghosts in the UK that are sort of given this friendly name of Fred. You know, I've come across a famous case in was it Cardiff, in a garage, and they had a poltergeist called him Pete.
Peter Paul. Well, you know, I'll tell you, I love it's such a British thing, right? It's such a British thing. No disrespect to our American cousins. I am an American. I have a piece of paper that says so. A dual citizen. But Americans treat it very differently. The Brits love their ghosts. We are kind of like, we treat our ghosts like the pub dog. You know, and when I was growing up in Britain, every pub had a dog, and I think every pub should have a dog. And in the same way, every pub seemed to have its own ghost story. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, my auntie had a pub called the Cherry Tree. She ran pubs around Cheshire and Merseyside. And
yeah.
She had a pub in Chester called the Cherry Tree. And they called their resident ghost Fred. And he was very obliging as well, Richard. He was like, Fred, shut the door, and the door would close.
Well, it's Fred sounds like the name of that nice bloke that hangs out at the bar.
Yeah.
Or the next door, you know. You know, Fred next door but one.
Yeah.
Like that's a phrase you never hear anymore either.
Yeah.
You know, you used to refer to your neighbours as like Fred next door.
Yeah.
Or to this day, there was a woman I played with her kids and when I was a boy, and I only know her as Linda next door but one.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think I ever knew her last name.
Yeah.
And it's one of those very British things, right? You know, the ghost, Fred or Pete or Bill.
Yeah.
we're not calling our ghost Beelzebub.
Or no, whatever. No. Absolutely.
They're not scary, are they?
No, I think, like you say, I think that's to kind of demystify it a little bit and put a bit of, and it is interesting that it seems to, in certain cases, it seems to respond to being given a pet name, I think.
Yeah, at Enfield, as much fear as was created, I mean, the poltergeist became part of the family.
Yes, yeah.
And maybe not a welcome one initially, but still they started to treat it that way, because what more rational way is there to treat someone that's living in your house, even though they weren't invited?
Mm.
You have an uninvited intruder. You have to do something about that to cope with it, or it's going to drive you berserk.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing as well. You know, we laugh about these things. The thing about Enfield and Pontefract is the, you know, the psychological strain that both families were under is something that, yes, we can laugh about them living as a ghost, and I often find it perplexing when people put the hoaxing explanation forward, regardless of how much activity was recorded in both cases.
Well, you know, I think the issue with Enfield was that there was fraud.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they caught the girls out a couple of times, but
yeah.
what arguments being made by Gross and Playfair, who I have a ton of respect for,
yes,
by the way, they said, you know, just because, let's say 5 or even 10% of this was two girls playing actively, we witnessed things.
Yeah.
Police officers witnessed things,
yeah,
that cannot be explained away by two little girls making noises with their throats or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are certain aspects of that case. I think some people just focus on things they can dismiss, Richard, and they don't, you know, I mean, there was the situation. One of the famous incidents I remember is that Gross was sat in the bedroom with the two girls sort of challenging Bill, and a box flew across the room and hit him on the head. There was nobody
right
else in the room. So do we assume that either, essentially what they're saying there is either Gross is lying or something of psychic phenomenon happened.
Well, and it comes down to the whole throw the baby out with the bathwater, doesn't it, Paul?
Absolutely.
When I argue with, and I consider myself to be somewhat skeptical in a lot of cases, I approach anything with a, you know, what's the evidence? What's the testimony?
Yes.
But it's where you set that bar.
Mm.
And I think too many skeptics with a capital S take the opinion, I can demonstrate how this could be faked quite easily, therefore it was.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? Because it can be faked, it was faked, which is, to me, faulty logic.
Yeah.
My argument about it is that if you look at Enfield, you only have to have just one of the 100 examples,
mm,
or Pontefract for that matter.
Yeah.
One incident has to be genuine,
yeah,
and you have something a skeptic cannot explain. A skeptic has to be right 100% of the time.
Yep.
Yeah. Right, they have to absolutely provide an explanation for every single piece of phenomena,
yeah,
which you cannot do, to my satisfaction, at Enfield or Pontefract.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the minute you concede that there is just one inexplicable thing,
that's it.
Then, you know, it all starts to unravel.
Absolutely, all bets are off at that point. I mean, it's one of those things, Richard. I mean, I'm sick to death of. I was watching a program, whilst I know this is not within your parameters normally, about the Hopkinsville UFO case the other day. And
is that the one with the goblins?
That's the one. And
mm-hmm.
A very well-known skeptic claimed, we have to accept this as true because he's a skeptic, and obviously they don't lie, that a police officer told him he'd seen some beer cans, so therefore everybody was so drunk that they were hallucinating. Yet, you're a man in the medical profession, Richard. How many normal drinking people have you ever met that hallucinate through drinking alcohol?
Yeah, it's actually pretty rare.
yet everybody that sees a UFO is... I think that comes from, though, you know, those old 1920s, 30s films where something weird happens and the local dropout's having a drink and he vows never to drink it. He looks at his bottle and throws it away.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those...
But it's also an easy explanation, right? It's an easy cop-out. It's an easy dismissal. Yeah. You know, I mean, when I investigate, I have a no-alcohol policy, not even one. And it's purely because I have one beer and someone can say you were under the influence. Mm. Never mind that you can drive legally after one beer.
Yes.
You know, so it's just gotten easier so we don't have to have the conversation to do it that way. And I think we see the same with what you're talking about, Paul, you know? So the implication being that some beer cans were seen and therefore everyone, adults and children alike, were all raging drunk.
Yeah, yeah, and shooting at bulletproof owls.
Right.
It's one of my favourite cases. The whole thing just makes me chuckle because it's just so odd. So, obviously, how long did you stay in Pontefract? Is it still owned by, is it a gentleman called Bill, is it Bungay?
Bungay, yeah, Bill Bungay. It is still owned by Bill. I stayed there. I did two trips, and my first one was for 4.5 days. Mm-hmm. And then my second one, I went back and I did another 24 hours because I was in Hull. And I was mad enough. I said, oh, you know what? Pontefract's not far. Mm-hmm. I wonder if I can get in the house again for the night. Mm-hmm. And I did. So all in all, we're looking at, let's call it 5 days, right? Mm-hmm. A working week, basically. And it's interesting because you watch the TV shows. I moved out just a couple of days before Nick and Katrina moved in to do Paranormal Lockdown.
Yes.
And they got more activity than we did. Mm-hmm. We kind of primed the pump for them. But the first thing I got in that house, I hadn't been there in an hour. Mm. And then we had a whole day of nothing. So, you know, I'm always suspicious when you see something on TV. And it kind of builds to a climax.
Yeah.
So it was good to see their show and see that it was kind of all over the place, that you don't get a big last day, as it were.
Yeah.
Our best result came in the first hour in the house.
Yeah.
And it was all over the map.
Yeah. Plus, I suppose that also kind of, once again, puts a knock on the hoaxing angle, because that's the other thing about hoaxing is that I think sometimes, and there have been numerous cases over the years that have been proven. One of my favourites from the history of British paranormal is the wonderful Cock Lane ghost with scratching Fanny.
Oh God, the jokes write themselves, don't they?
Oh, those. I mean that was obviously a young lady with a board under the bed that was rumbled after a week. But you know, there are numerous scenarios very similar to that, and yet with these cases, it would lend themselves, if it was hoaxing, it would just be out of control. Whereas I think for a lot of these well documented cases, Richard, it isn't that sporadic. It's quite odd, and it doesn't sort of all go mad all the time. It's just little things here and there.
And that's it, right? That's where you set your bar for evidence. You have to have the patience to sit and accept some of those small things, and not expect the spectacular. It comes down to revising your expectations.
Absolutely. Well, absolutely loved both books. I think they're fascinating subjects, really interested. So I know we had a chat about what your forthcoming plans are, and we were, obviously, we discussed Baumeister, and we might as well touch on a very notorious serial killer, which I think is something you're going to be working on for the rest of this year, Richard, which is the infamous John Wayne Gacy.
Yeah, that book actually should be out in the spring. I did most of the work for it last year, but
fantastic.
What takes a lot of time when I'm writing is usually the evidence review. You know, going over the hours and hours and hours of audio and video evidence. So Gacy haunts, allegedly, mm-hmm. a movie theater in a small town called Auburn, Illinois.
Yeah.
And so the owner, again, allowed me to move in with my team to figure out what was going on and do my own investigation. So we had some interesting times in that location. I think more than John Wayne Gacy is active there. Mm. But it was a pretty funny story. The guy that owns the place is somewhat into the paranormal, it's fair to say. Yeah. And when he bought a movie theater, a cinema, He started noticing that things were going on, strange things were taking place. So he called in some paranormal investigators and called in some mediums. And one of the mediums said, I'm picking up on a man who goes by the name John Wayne. And he goes, well, that's amazing. The Duke is haunting my movie theater. That's brilliant. Picturing John Wayne, and then the medium go, well, why would he be wearing a clown suit? So it was only then they started to realize that there were connections with John Wayne Gacy. One of the owners, for example, her college roommate had been connected directly to Gacy by means of one of the murders. That they owned an armoire, a wooden cabinet, at the movie theater. It's there to this day, which had belonged to one of Gacy's lawyers and had been used to store some of his paintings in. So that's a direct physical connection with Gacy. So I suddenly found myself with another serial killer case on the books, and I'd really, who turns down the opportunity to see if somebody like John Wayne Gacy is haunting a location.
I mean, Gacy is a particularly nasty individual. And once again, Richard, he's one of those that I think that there is an opportunity to flag this gentleman up very early. And I think it's the era it occurred in. I mean, I find it incredible when you look back at that case that he was arrested and charged with sexual molestation of a boy.
Sodomy, yeah.
Sodomy, received a 10-year sentence. Plus, he paid someone to beat him up, beat the victim up as well, didn't he? Which obviously led to his downfall because the attacker confessed why he'd been paid $300, I think, to sort this kid out, sadly. But he received 10 years, yet he only served two because he once again he's another, as we touched on with Ted Bundy, another gentleman. High school dropout, troubled home life, yet had the gift of the gab and could charm his way through anything.
If you look at him in prison, he was quote unquote a model prisoner. He became the head of the kitchen, so he made himself useful and stayed out of trouble for the most part. And so, he was one of those chameleon-like serial killers that could twist your perception of him to a degree to get what he wanted. He was very heavily involved in politics to the point where there's a picture of him shaking the hand of the First Lady. I want to say it's Jimmy Carter's wife. And then the whole clown thing, which he would do as a children's entertainer. When somebody asked him about that, he said, clowns can get away with murder. And he wasn't kidding.
Yeah, I mean, I always find one of the most disturbing aspects of that case is when he'd been rumbled, and the police went to investigate the house. Now, I'm not sure if this you'll probably know a lot more about this, Richard, having worked on it recently. I remember seeing an interview with one of the officers who had the difficult job of going into this crawl space, and he claimed he was in there a few minutes and he noticed the ground was moving. And he cl basically there were that many bodies buried in this space. It was simply the worms and maggots that were moving the ground. Now, is that true, or is that just one of these exaggerations that's been added to the case? Because the case itself is horrific.
Yeah, I've certainly never heard of that.
I'll try and flag it if I can find that. I'm definitely sure I've seen somebody talk about it, Richard. If I find it, I'll send
Yeah,
it
if
to you.
you
But
would.
if you've not come across that, then I suggest that was exaggeration for dramatic purposes by someone.
I mean, maybe, but I don't know. Or the house itself was demolished, so thankfully, and then they did build. They changed the lot number, and they built a new house from scratch on that lot. So there is a house there again, which, to my knowledge, has no reputation for being haunted. And I think that the owners just don't want, any of this kind of publicity anyway. But in terms of that crawl space, I mean, Gacy had some of his own victims dig their own graves. He would send them down there and have them, dig, and the whole place stank even when he had them scatter quicklime around to try and dissipate the smell. Absolutely awful, awful individual. And I brought one of my friends, Brad Kling, from Ghost Lab. Wonderful man. So he's the guy that put me onto this case, to give him absolute credit. He'd been there to shoot his new TV show. He'd shot an episode in this location and had been very provocative with Gacy. I mean, I have never seen another investigator provoke like Brad Kling does.
Mm.
Whenever he gets going, it's like watching the Full Metal Jacket. The man swears so inventively and creatively, but he's able to get a rise. He's able to get activity out of Gacy. So, or at least whatever is there that claims to be him. I don't hang my hat on the fact that John Wayne Gacy is 100% haunting that location, but certainly something that likes to respond as if it is him is there. And Brad just went nuclear on Gacy, just swearing up and down a storm. I was transcribing this for the book, and I'm like, I have to put this in unedited. Mm. I've never written the F key on my keyboard now doesn't work. but it got us results. We Skyped him in all the way from Texas, put him on speaker, and then Gacy supposedly likes to hang out on this balcony, which is above the garage that was the main auditorium when this was a movie theater. So I go up there on the most rickety lift you can imagine, elevator. It's the most terrifying thing I've seen at that location is this elevator. You think it's going to come down whenever you go up it. But so I'm up there in the middle of a thunderstorm with my tablet Skyping in Brad, who is just raging and screaming, and I've got movement in the darkness up to my left. It was pretty intimidating, to be honest with you. You know, he's taunting Gacy, coming out, this stuff moving in the darkness off to my left. I go, look, there's nothing there, you know, no rats or mice or critters or anything like that. And then I just got done doing the EVP review last week, and there is a man's voice, and it says he's got them. Which I cannot explain it at all. There was nobody on that balcony with me. I'll tell you for free. I was 30 feet above the ground.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, was it one of those things that you didn't notice it at the time and it was only on playback you caught it, Richard? Or did you hear it at the time, yeah?
Nope, nothing at the time. And it was in the middle of a thunderstorm too. Like, all you can hear directly at the time is raindrops bouncing off the tin roof above your head.
Mm.
It was the classic dark and stormy night, you know. but yeah, I heard the footsteps and the I should say I heard the movement. It might be presumptuous to call it footsteps, because your own imagination does like to play tricks in cases such. I heard that with my own ears and went to look and found nothing. But as for the rest of it, the voice, the EVPs, no, only later did we pick that up.
I mean, it's a case where I think, regardless of which aspect you look at it, whether you look at the murders or the potential haunting of him, he's such a loathsome individual. And, you know, when you dive into this case, it must be difficult sometimes, Richard. I think when you have to sort of uncover these horrific crimes, because, you know, whilst I appreciate there is I would say love is the wrong word, an appreciation for the serial killer, as many people talk about, you know, watching things on Netflix and Unsolved Mysteries, and it's given people an appetite to learn about or be engaged in these people. And we see, you know, America's Most Notorious and the UK's Worst. There's a real sort of industry around this. But is it difficult when you have to go back into such a, I mean, obviously, because Gacy is such a difficult case, because essentially we're talking about child molestation and murder.
Mm-hmm.
It must be difficult sometimes, Richard, when you have to sort of balance up the aspects of the fantastical and the paranormal with the brutal reality of such a case as John Wayne Gacy.
It is, and researching and all this kind of stuff is one thing. Doing it at the location as well, where either the crimes took place is in Fox Hollow, or somewhere that, you know, dealing with objects that have a connection with that individual, it kind of adds a whole new dimension to it. I spent several nights, and I'm still researching this book, in the Villisca Axe Murder House, which is, you know, I seem to have just done a rash of these cases in the past year or two.
Yes,
I went from being that haunted hospitals guy to being the paranormal serial killer guy without really figuring out how that happened. But definitely it can be difficult to find that balance. And the main thing, I think, is that in more contemporary cases where the family of some of the victims are still living, you don't want to open old wounds, and you have to handle it in as sensitive a way as you can.
Yeah, much so. I mean, Gacy is an extremely long... I always found it... It just sums him up that I think when he was... Was he electrocuted or was he given a lethal injection?
He was given the lethal injection, which... And it didn't work the first time. They actually had to troubleshoot and adjust it. And he complained about it. His last meal was Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yeah, because he used to be a KFC manager, didn't he?
He did, yeah. In fact, not too far from the movie theater where we investigated, he did. And they gave him the lethal injection. And his last words were, kiss my ass, I believe.
Yes, yeah, that's. I think that sums him up in three words. A thoroughly loathsome individual with no redeeming features. But yet again, another one that, I think, was he executed in 94?
I'd have to look it up to confirm the exact year.
Yeah, because he was on death row for quite a long time, because I think he was arrested in 78.
Well, and he maintained his innocence to the he tried to say, and it's kind of funny. Funny is a careful word.
Yeah, I know where you're coming from.
But there was a movie made with Brian Dennehy playing Gacy.
Yes.
Brian Dennehy got hate mail from Gacy because of that movie. And he said to Brian Dennehy, he said, you know, I respected you. You were my favorite actor until you appeared in this travesty. And he said, you know, as far as the murders go, lots of people had access to that crawl space.
Yeah,
I'm like, well, I'm convinced, John. I don't know about you. Lots of people, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, they didn't find handcuffs and you know, bloodied sexual toys on lots of people's houses. That was all you, wasn't it, John?
Yeah, absolutely. Or receipts of dead people in your house.
Right, and that the stuff he'd taken as trophies, but till the very end he kept up this charade that he was innocent.
Yeah, well, it was once again he was a pariah of a pillar of the community. He was a well respected man, despite the fact that once again nobody knew he was a convicted paedophile, because that's what he was. He was able to build a new life. He just moved away and got married again. He basically recreated himself in a different area, which is incredible when you think about it this day and age, Richard. So it's he's just such an obnoxiously loathsome character. I know people sometimes go, have that conversation, Richard, who's your favourite serial killer? And I think when you deal with the macabre, it's sometimes difficult to not seem like we're trying to offend people when you say something like that. But I think it's not that, oh, it's my favourite, I love him. It's that, well, what's the one that gives you the willies the most? And Gacy's always been one of those characters that the whole thing's just, it makes your skin crawl.
It does, and my heart goes out to everyone that was involved with it, especially those that had to investigate that location.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the crime scene. You know, just the things they pulled out of that house. He only stopped burying people there and dumping them in rivers.
Yes.
Because he finally reached a point where there was no more room under his house.
Yeah. Was there 25 he buried under the house, Richard?
I want to say it's more than that, actually.
Was there 33 victims?
There were 33 in total, and I want to say the last two or three went... It's in my notes, and I'd have to check.
Yeah.
But the last two or three went into a river off a bridge.
Yeah.
And then finally he was caught. But yeah, he ran out of room. underneath his own house, which is just ridiculous, isn't it?
I mean, that's the kind of situation, like, you know what I mean, when you're investigating that, you're like, where on earth does this end?
And if he could have kept going, I mean, that's the scary thing, isn't it?
Well, it was
they get complacent,
cocky,
though.
Cocky.
And then that's it. He let the wrong victim live.
Yes.
And the victim got away and was able to identify him. And we see that over and over.
Mm.
You look at these serial killers, they think they're so smart, they're so ego-driven, or the majority of them are, right up until the point when they're not.
Yeah. I mean, he was on the... I mean, that's the thing about the Gacy. He was under investigation when somebody else disappeared. And the family were absolutely convinced, and all they knew was that this young lad had gone for an interview with a contractor. And his mum was insistent that it was completely out of character that a son would vanish. And basically, I think, was he within 48 hours that got him?
Yeah, and the police, though, had him under constant surveillance.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing. They'd been following him around town. He would buy them drinks.
Yeah.
They'd go to a bar to you know, keep an eye on him, and he would send them drinks across.
Yeah.
I mean, he was that kind of guy. And you see that with a lot of serial killers, too. I mean, Edmund Kemper was one that liked to hang out with cops as well. They gave him handcuffs that he used in one of his murders.
Yeah.
You know? So it's kind of crazy.
Well, once again, goes to that sort of seduction personality that these people tend to have, some of the more prolific and successful ones, Richard.
And also, I think there's a degree of thumbing their nose at,
yes,
at, you know, I'm getting away with all this and you won't know. I mean, when you read the Fox Hollow book, do you recall the video with the squirrel?
Yes.
It's either a squirrel or a raccoon. I always forget which. But But I would encourage your listeners to go have a look on YouTube. If you Google Herb Baumeister if the video hits that come up, one is a local news segment. And it involves this animal, the squirrel, I believe it is. Was it a squirrel or a raccoon? You just told me.
I think it was a raccoon.
Yeah, okay. So we'll go with raccoon. Mm-hmm. But it's this, so this thing gets hit by a car outside Fox Hollow Farm. There's a road crew that's coming along to paint the roads.
Yeah.
And what they do is they spray paint over its body. They don't move it or anything like that. He complains to the local council about it, and, you know, and this video is shot in the driveway of Fox Hollow. So he's standing on a murder scene, essentially.
Yeah.
Behind him, just a few hundred feet, are the trees where he has dumped the bodies of at least 10, but probably more victims. So they're rotting just a few hundred feet behind him. And he's saying, how dare they show such disrespect to the body of this innocent animal? It's terrible. They should lose their jobs, you know. And if you watch the video, you know, it's just, it looks like your local busybody just having a whinge. But when you know who he is and when you know what's in the woods behind him, it adds a whole new dimension. It's genuinely chilling.
Yeah.
And I talked to the guy that knew him, and he said, that's Herb getting off on the fact that, you know, I know something that none of you people know. You know, I've got one over on you. And you see that come up time and time again with serial killers.
Yeah, there's an arrogant... Well, a lot of them, you know, possess these arrogant, narcissistic traits, Richard. And I think it just fuels that kind of power that they feel that they, as you refer to there with Herb, they know something everybody else doesn't. And it's a terrifying thing, but they're so clever. No one else will ever know about this. I mean, that's the arrogance that tends to drive them, which often causes the mistakes that lead to them being caught.
Absolutely. Fortunately, it's just a shame that sometimes it takes a little too long.
Yeah. Well, often, sometimes they slip through the net. You know, Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, is a prime example. I think the police interviewed him 5 times.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely, absolutely crazy. But, you know, once again, that's a different era and a different level of policing, I think, which also led into that. I don't think it was just, you know, bad investigations. I just think it was the era it was in that helped.
Well, and it's also interesting, isn't it, that you would think anyone that was remotely clever would have said, you know, I think I'll lay low for a bit.
Yeah.
I think I'll let this all blow over. But they don't, do they? They go about doing what they're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and once again, caught on the off chance. The off chance in the red light district in Sheffield by a 2 policemen, one who'd been in the force 6 months. Incredible. So, Richard, thank you for your conversation. It's been fabulous having a real good chat. I think we've gone on a wonderfully macabre, meandering path. So thank you for entertaining my strange and delightful tangents. So, obviously, you've touched on your next books coming out. So when's the release date, and where else can everybody keep up to date with your work and your personal website, Richard?
Gacy book should be out early March. It will be available from Amazon, primarily. The serial killer book I'm working on at the moment, which has no paranormal aspect to it, will be out at the end, I think, of the year, depending on when the publisher decides to give it the final rubber stamp. But you can find all my books and come chat to me online at richardestep.net or on Facebook, Richard Estep Author. I look forward to talking to some of you.
Brilliant. I look forward to both releases. I shall be adding them to my my shopping cart on Amazon, as usual. And hopefully we'll get the opportunity to talk to you again when either of them are out, if that's possible, Richard, at some point in the future. We'd love to have you back.
I'll look forward to it, but thank you.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for your time today, Richard.
Cheers, Paul. Have a great day.